Nope. Seen it. Oh, nah.
Can't find something to watch? Introducing Sky Stream. It's Sky without the dish. Watch unmissable Sky exclusives like The Regime and Netflix too, all over super reliable Sky full fibre broadband. Get Sky Stream, Sky Broadband and Netflix for just €50 a month. Search Sky Stream. Availability subject location. New customers only. 12-month minimum term. Stream and broadband sold separately. Further terms apply. For more info, see sky.ie/speeds.
Seachtain. An Indo Ascaelige.
Time I mon iroachtaí a dhéanamh teacht ar a chorp. Agus súligam amach an seo, gur féidir é a chur in uaig ceart lena bhaintir féin.
Scíltaí, fios, tuairimí.
Tá sé dochreite nach bhféadfach ara i gcuirna meáin an cheist sin a eicáil.
Bhí an talam a gnám go raibh orthcháir na reachtam. Iadach sé tarraing go raibh an orthcháir san i lis dúthail agus gimine fanacht gór a chlig sár ducha sin éachar. Ná ní bhin ann thar d'oraach sin, bhin marav.
Seachtain. Find us on all the usual podcast platforms.
The day after Gary Hutch died, I was actually at Dublin Airport. I was on my way to Malaga to investigate really what had happened. And it was early, 7 a.m., one of those red-eye flights. I was wandering around, I got some coffees, and I sat down with the photographer and I was sort of rooting through my handbag. And the next thing, this thing caught my eye, just the corner of my eye, and it was sort of this grey colour. It was out of place. I looked again, and over where the gold circle passengers were, now they're the first classers, I was in economy, of course, was these three people, and they all came into vision at the one time. There was this sort of big burly guy in a Canada Goose jacket with orange skin. There was a very glamorous looking woman. And then there was this guy in double grey. And I just looked and realised it was Daniel Kinahan. It was a very strange situation. I was about to board a flight with him to Spain, which was the seat of his power. He was the head of the Irish Mafia, and his best friend had just been killed, and he was the chief suspect for directing that murder. So it was one hell of a flight.
The Kinahan gang is one of the biggest drug cartels in the world. But how did Daniel Kinahan make his way from the streets of Dublin to become a narco? I'm Fionnán Sheehan and you're listening to the Indo Daily. Today I'm joined by Nicola Tallant, Sunday World Investigations editor and author of Clash of the Clans, to talk about the rise of the Irish Mafia.
When drug squad detectives raided the luxury apartment at Fairview last September, they found Serrier and Dubliner Christopher Kinahan with over £100,000 worth of heroin, some of it ready for distribution to other dealers in the city. Subsequent investigations revealed that Kinahan, who lived in a tenement building in the York Street area of the city, had rented the luxury apartment for £220 a month. Gardaí believed the apartment was the nerve centre of a big drugs ring.
So Christy Kinahan, as you heard in that clip, was arrested in the late 1980s. You have to remember that was a time when we were still engulfed in the heroin epidemic. So heroin was the drug to sell if you wanted to make money. And he had actually taken over the market from Larry Dunn, who had famously been imprisoned, warning about who would come after him. But Kinahan, unlike others that were in the drug world and had seen the opportunities in drugs from the late 70s into the 1980s, wasn't from a working class environment. He was actually a middle class guy who'd been brought up in a very structured, stable family. He'd been educated. He was good at everything he put his hands to, and he had choices in life. And most of his contemporaries within the criminal underworld would have come from very, very poor backgrounds, really, and they went into crime probably initially because they had to. So it kind of made him a little bit of a cuckoo in the nest. He had a relationship with a woman called Jean Boylan, who lived in Oliver Bond Flats. They had split, but they had two boys, Daniel and Christopher Jr. She reared them in Oliver Bond. Now, she was actually very anti-drugs and would help out the addicts and in community projects and all the rest of it. But clearly, it was difficult for the boys growing up to turn their back on this father who was such a significant player on the scene, even though he went to jail at that point. for a few years. He used it to his advantage, and he met with a guy called John Cunningham in jail, and together they started what would become the Irish Mafia. After his relief, he moved to Amsterdam and started to set up a headquarters in Spain. And as Daniel and Christopher Jr. entered their teenage years, they are based in Oliver Bond, where they're forming their own gang. They have reached out to contacts in the Hardwick Street Flats area. They have friends in the North Inner City. And these are a group of a young kind of brat pack that come together. The Kinahans stand out because of their father's connections in Europe and because he's a wholesaler. And I suppose together they form for the first time as one united group. Dublin was always, you know, worked in pockets where you had gangs in different parts of the city. But when the Kinahans came along, this was an opportunity for everybody to join forces, almost like the five families. And they realised that, you know, graduation was in Spain.
So you had a fully fledged international drug operation.
You did, absolutely.
Born and bred in Dublin.
Born and bred in Dublin and making waves in the Netherlands. He just grows and grows. He seems to be always lucky, always in the right place at the right time. And moving from heroin, they were entering this young brat pack who were coming up under him. They were entering the gold rush of cocaine. So there was money beyond their wildest dreams there.
And at that point, is Dublin still the nexus, the most important part of the operation, or do you feel that Dublin just became a kind of a subsidiary of a wider European network?
Yeah, well, Dublin was very important to them, definitely. They had established a very serious operation here, and they were also around from 2000 onwards, they were taking over Ireland. They were taking over the whole of Ireland. But they had, I suppose you'd call them franchises across the UK. They had them in Scotland, they had them in Liverpool, in very significant territories in the UK, which would actually be, the likes of Liverpool would be similar in scale in its drug market to the whole of Ireland, you know.
And at what point did he pass on the family? I mean, Succession is the most popular TV show on around at the moment. When did it go from one generation to the next?
That's interesting, because that seems to happen around 2014, down in Spain. So they're very established down there. We have been told they were shut down in 2010 by the Spanish and other European police forces went against them in a thing called Operation Shovel, which was a disaster. They were back up and running in 2012, despite the fact that we were told the Irish Mafia had been shut down. And Kinahan Sr. goes to jail again in Belgium in and around 2014. And that seems to be a moment for him that he decides he wants out. He doesn't want to be doing this anymore, because he's actually in and out of jail, like, you know, constantly throughout his career, while Daniel hasn't been. He certainly has. And he doesn't like jail, Kinahan Sr., at all. He's a really sophisticated lifestyle at this point. And he, I think, just gets fed up with it and hands over the reins to Daniel, who wants to be bigger and better than the father before him.
Nicola, within 18 months, effectively, of Daniel taking over the cartel, we have the start of what becomes known as the Kinahan Hutch feud, with the murder of Gary Hutch.
Gardaí say they're concerned about the possibility of retaliation after the murder of gangland criminal Gary Hutch. The 34-year-old was shot dead on the Costa del Sol in Spain yesterday. Gardaí say he knew his life was in danger.
Gary Hutch, a well-known criminal, nephew of Jerry the Monk Hutch. Why was he killed, and where did things go from there?
Yeah, I suppose you can see for the decades that the father, Christy Kinahan Sr., is in charge, there's stability. And as soon as Daniel Kinahan takes the reins, there is problems. Now, obviously, he wasn't just killed in a flash. It wasn't just a one-day thing. When we look back on it, we can see what's going on there in the background that leads to that. There's accusations of touting. There is accusations that there have been money's gone missing. There is claims then from the that basically that Daniel Kinahan has made new friends as such, and he has ambitions that go beyond, and maybe is leaving behind some of the old pals from Dublin. Maybe there's no room for them in the new place. We see in recent times from DEA documents that Daniel Kinahan is at this point making connections with some other mafias down in the Costa. He is creating what is now known as the super cartel. And this was four mafias coming together and to bring in bigger loads of cocaine. And this is all happening just before Gary Hutch is murdered.
From there, then, we get into a retaliatory cycle.
Look, following Gary Hutch's murder, everybody was, I think anybody who knew anything about the criminal underworld was very aware that this was no ordinary murder and there would be a retaliation, or it wasn't just going to be left as was. Coming up to the new year of 2015 into 2016, there was an attempt on the life of the monk in Lanzarote. And then in February, there was the Regency.
The guy leaned over the receptionist's desk and pointed the gun at me, so I was looking down the barrel of his gun and I was shouting, "Don't shoot, don't shoot." He said something to me that I can't quite remember what it was, just maybe two words, and then he left again. The guy who was shot right beside me at that time, that is the man who's now died.
Three men appeared coming in the side door, fully dressed in Gardaí uniforms, absolutely fully dressed, with Gardaí in front of them, in front of their jackets and their back of their jackets. And then I noticed they had three shotguns. A number of shots went off. There was one man standing at reception who was shot.
And I mean, this was an explosion of violence between the two sides. This was an attempt to take out Daniel Kinahan. It failed, and it resulted in the feud, as we call it. But as you can see, if you delve back into it, the feud has developed long before that moment in the Regency Hotel. It's probably the most significant moment in gangland history in this country. You had two sides going to war who were once one grouping, who knew everything about one another, who knew everything about one another's relatives, where they lived. A very dangerous situation. Family members were seen as fair game. Anybody was seen as fair game. Very dangerous, volatile time. And I think for the first time in probably since the murder of Veronica Guerin, it was enough for the politicians to stand up and realise that what we were entering was an area that was bringing us towards a narco-terrorism. You were seeing drug gangs believing that they could take up Kalashnikovs in crowded places in this country. And they were also seeing themselves as being above and beyond the law and the state.
The north side of Dublin effectively became a battle zone mm-hmm. for quite a period of time. That probably the whole year of 2016 was just dominated by armed police on the street. Murders taking place in broad daylight. But the feud effectively, it ultimately became a massacre. It became very one-sided. The Kinahan cartel just looking to wipe out, members of the Hutch organisation and people just associated with them. Innocent people getting caught up as well. How many people ultimately died in what became known as the Kinahan-Hutch feud?
Well, 18 to 20, some of the murders are a little bit more complex than just they were totally feud-related, but 18 to 20 people, and that seems to be actually a kind of an average almost nearly in these feud situations before they abate. I think there's complex reasons why it was so uneven, but by and large, you know, to put it basically, the Kinahans had more money. And what they did was they threw money at Dublin and they were paying retainers to people who were neighbours of some of their former friends, now their rivals. And they were paying them money to keep an eye out, to spot, to watch for when there was an opportunity to kill. They were paying hit teams to... There was cars, actually. I mean, we wouldn't have even realised. We'd be walking down the street oblivious to the fact that there was cars parked up. They were ready to go and, you know, there was guns in the back of them. They were ready to go and assassinate people at all times. So that's really what became unfair. And also, I think Gerry Hutch went to look for some backing and didn't get it, places that he thought he would. Everybody who he looked for backing from said they wanted to remain neutral. And their neutrality, in a way, empowered the Kinahans because it was just a very unfair, uneven battle. And it was a massacre.
Nick, I suppose the Regency incident does, though, bring to public attention Daniel Kinahan's involvement in boxing and his MTK organisation and gyms and boxing promotion. why does he get involved in that?
Well, I think it's one of his passions in life, basically. And I suppose if you have the money to pump into one of your passions, you will. 2012 out in Spain was the first time we realised he had a boxing club. I was actually out there investigating the Kinahan mob and discovered this, you know, little gym down a laneway near Puerto Banús. And it was Matthew Macklin's MGM. But when we looked, we could see that Daniel Kinahan was the one that was dealing with the builders. While initially he stayed in the background with all the functions and the openings, he slowly kind of gained confidence and started coming to the forefront. And they started signing all these boxers, all these really well-known boxers. Then the boxers started saying that Daniel Kinahan was their manager, and they started, and slowly his name went into sort of legitimacy within that boxing world. And of course,
because he has the money basically to hire them at better rates than other managers can, and he has the money to pump into to promotion of them as well.
Well, that's what you would think. Now, to try and, does he do that? Because he claims, no, he doesn't. I mean, they claimed that MGM was initially set up as a non-for-profit organization in Spain. There's never been any explanation where the money came from it. I think by 2016, around the time it moved its headquarters from Spain to Dubai, it had 100 boxers signed, which is unprecedented. And at that point, and shortly after the Regency, we're told that it sold outright to Sandra Vaughan, a businesswoman, and that Kinahan has nothing more to do with it, although he does slip in and out of publicity around it for the next few years. But yeah, ultimately it was his passion. And I think, you know, he has ambitions, and he has ambitions to be somebody very special within the world of boxing. Interestingly, after the Regency, when you were having this massacre here in Dublin and so much funding was going into the fight against organised crime here, that Daniel Kinahan was being called out and in years to follow in the High Court as the head of the Kinahan Organised Crime Group, a murderous drug dealing and weapons law, dealing operation. He was still going from strength to strength in the boxing world. And as a reporter, it was kind of strange because you had two trajectories, even in the same newspaper. You'd have one element of the media describing Daniel Kinahan every time he came up, or every time this boxing or his links to boxing came up, it was the mob boss behind this boxing thing. And you had the sports journalists who were just ignoring it completely. And they were sort of writing about, you know, the likes of Tyson Fury, who he would later sign to MGM, about his background and his famous comeback, and there wasn't a word about Daniel Kinahan. So it was all very strange. And that's really how it's continued onwards. I mean, the boxing community, professional boxing at its highest level, has ignored the fact that Daniel Kinahan is involved and what his background is.
Hello there. I'm just after getting off the phone with Daniel Kinahan. He just informed me that the biggest fight in British boxing history has just been agreed. Get up there, my boy! Big shout out, Dan. He got this done.
But this feeds into the narrative, the spin that Daniel Kinahan wants to put out there. You note in your book, Lashes to Cleanse, when you say Daniel Kinahan likes to play mind games, he likes to control and manipulate at all times. He's particularly dangerous because he has had the foresight not only to do that within his own world, but also to focus on the media who have been directly targeted by him. He's enjoyed some success, but while most public relations officers send out press releases, Kinahan does so on anonymous social media and encrypted emails where he claims to be someone he is not. So he's quite a manipulative figure. So you see the boxing promotion feeding into that whole thing of the myth of Danny Kinahan.
100%. I mean, every time he steps forward, and most recently, and probably what everybody would recall, was when Tyson Fury called him out as the power broker behind hasn't been arranged yet, but at the time he felt it was the biggest boxing bout in history. And he calls him out as the power broker behind that. And what you see then is all the boxers and this huge, big sort of marketing campaign. We can see that in media, that's what it is. But they're all coming forward with stories about Daniel Kinahan, how good a guy he is, how amazing an advisor he is, because they don't describe him as a manager. And that's where the loophole is in the boxing regulations. You don't need a license to be an advisor. You do to be a manager. So he's all of a sudden gone from where he was once described as manager, and the trail is there. I mean, it's for anyone to see. He's all of a sudden an advisor. So it's all very clever, and it's all very, it always works in tandem. You see Bob Arum, the Las Vegas promoter, coming out to sing him up. He said he was one of the best guys he'd ever met. And they all come out one after the other, and there's this big campaign, Daniel Kinahan's a good guy. But then he has to slip into the background again because there is a corporate problem for the sport to try and deal with big corporate entities. It's too uncomfortable.
We've spoken to people involved in the game and they've told us exactly what you've told us, mm-hmm. these people, but they are afraid to go on camera. Does that surprise you?
No, doesn't surprise me at all.
Why are you going on camera?
Well, because I think it's right. I'm not threatened. I'm not worried about, you know, these guys threatening me. You know, I've been involved in, you know, terrifying situations my whole life, so it doesn't bother me. But I think someone has got to look out for the sport. They really need to look at this situation very carefully, because it's bloody dangerous.
And within the sport of boxing itself, you have the Barry McGuigan has shone out as one of the very few people who's actually willing to speak up and call out Daniel Kinahan for who he is.
One of the very few. I mean, there's no doubt that there's a lot of people high up in boxing who've become very entangled with Daniel Kinahan, and I don't think they can get out of it. They have a problem. In the last couple of years, I had a meeting with somebody, I have to be a bit careful, but somebody sort of quite close to him and quite close to that very high-end boxing. And he asked me, like, when is he going to be arrested? I was told, a lot of them, very high up in professional boxing, are hoping to God that the police solve the problem for them and arrest him, because until they do, they have to continue with that mantra that he's a good guy, that there's, you know, he's done nothing wrong, he's no convictions. And they've kind of got in and they've no way out.
So, like, Daniel Kinahan, he's based in Dubai effectively permanently now.
Oh, absolutely. He moved there in 2016 around the September time. So the Regency happened in the February. By September, actually the MGM, still called MGM at the time, the gym was raided as part of the investigation into the murder of Gary Hutch. But at that point he was gone, as were the financial structures of MGM, which would later become MTK. They were both gone to Dubai, and he hasn't been back in Europe since. He got married there in 2017 at a wedding that has become quite famous because it's been brought up in a number of European organised crime court cases. It was doubled up as a crime summit, basically, between some of the biggest mafias in Europe, and appears to have been under surveillance, the wedding. So he's lived out there and he's running his business while, you know, the Kinahan empire as such has been dismantled here. We've 60 associates of the Kinahan organisation behind bars. Same has happened in the UK with his main, his main man in the UK behind bars at the moment, along with others. It's still a wholesaling operation. And, you know, you get that big and all you have to do really is throw your money at it. I mean, that's just the way it is in drugs.
And is it logistically, I suppose we've all got used to working from home in the last 18 months. Is it difficult to run a drugs operation from Dubai, that is where your primary market is Europe?
Not at all, sure. I mean, look, there was a time, and we go back to the beginning, when Daniel Kinahan had street soldiers and he knew them by name and they were buying his drugs and selling his drugs from. But now he is wholesaling massive shipments into Europe, and they're sold, and he's hands off from there on. So, you know, he's the CEO of an enormous business that has really got nothing to do. He probably doesn't know any of the people on the ground anymore, other than the ones who are still with him in Dubai.
You think that the net is getting tighter and the guards are going to get him?
100%. I mean, I do think he has been given a couple of maybe months or years anyway of freedom, extra freedom, because of COVID. But there certainly was a 5-year plan in place from 2016, which is now probably moved to a 6-7 year plan because of the pandemic. But Kinahan is the last man standing from the European super cartel, who who have been brought down by the forces of Europe and the DEA, the Australians, and a global kind of effort. And it must be a lonely place for him now. He's the last guy from all of that still left free in Dubai, where he's surrounded by bodyguards. He is becoming increasingly paranoid. There's only one guy he talks to, his right-hand man, Sean McGovern. And after that, he's afraid to meet anybody. He seems to be watching the clock and waiting for his time to come. There's a thing called Expo going on at the moment in Dubai, and I understand that they had wanted it cleaned up totally at that stage, but to date, Kinahan still remains free. But I think, I think it's just a matter of time. There's an inevitability to his end.
That was Sunday World Investigations editor Nicola Tallant. Nicola's book, Clash of the Clans, is available now in all good bookshops, and you can listen to Nicola on her Crime World podcast. I'm Fionnán Sheehan, and today's episode was produced by Mary Carroll, researched by Tabitha Monaghan, with sound design by John Smith. Archive clips courtesy of independent.ie, BBC Panorama and RTE. You can listen to the Indo Daily wherever you get your podcasts.